Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
I'll be here.
Good evening. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is the Las Vegas and the Mob Show. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next hour, I'll be your host. Tonight, I have a special guest, Mr. Tony Napoli. And Tony is the son of one of the most powerful and respected organized crime leaders of the modern era, Jimmy Napoli. And Jimmy was a capo and a made man with the Genovese crime family in New York City. And for quite some time, he ran one of the largest illegal gambling operations in the country. And his son, Tony, also was a member of the crime family. And he was also a boxer, professional boxer. And he had quite a story of his life in the mob and how he happened to get out of the mob and what changed his life around. And he's written a book that just came out entitled My Father, My Don. And it's the story of his life, and it gets into a lot of the his family background, his dad, and his own personal life, and his problems with alcohol addiction, and how he turned his life around. So, Tony, welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob.
Oh, thank you very much. I wish I was there. It must be warmer than it is here in New York.
Well, I'll tell you, it's not too warm today. I think it was a high of about 48.
Oh, yeah?
and we had some rain, so but I guess it's going to turn around later this week, so hopefully we'll get some where we're supposed to be.
How you doing at the airport? I hear you at the airport signing books.
Yes, I go out to the airport every Saturday morning at McCarran and do usually about 3 hours or so and meet some people and sell a few books and... And talk, but I'll tell you, the airports, you get to meet a wide variety of people. I mean, you know, from all over the world, and it's I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
How is your book doing, Tony?
Well, as far as I heard, it was number 37 on Amazon, and I sold 3,000 copies already in the past 2 months. I'm averaging 1,500 copies a month. However... the holidays, that's true, are here. And your reviews have helped me to publicize and get the public to know that what the lifestyle I came out of and how I found sobriety to help others is what my turning point in life is now, you know, in the past 15 years. So I appreciate all the feedback, whether it be favorable or whether it be negative, it helps me for what I'm going to do in the future with my life story. I know what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to stay in sobriety no matter what. Win, lose, or draw on the book, the story. I just want the public to know that you don't have to be a recovering alcoholic or a recovering gambler to go into sobriety. You can get in sobriety with a mental problem, too. It helps to follow the 12 steps.
Okay.
And I know you want to talk more about the mob
because
you're putting a museum together there next year.
Yes.
But ask me the questions now, and I'll tell you now that I want you to know that Donna and Nikki on that virtual book tour, really, I learned a lot from them, and that's how I got to meet you, Dennis.
Yes,
and it was
very
worthwhile. And I'm listed on the publishing authors, as well as MySpace, as well as YouTube. And they got my three videos going pretty strong. The videos I did, the one I did in Hollywood last year, at the beginning of the year, that they might do a weekly show on that, called Homemade. I was with seven other mob guys, ex-mob guys that are now trying to go straight, so we put it into a reality show.
Sure.
And it was produced and financed by Stephanie Fitch. And we'll see what happens. So far, we got some favorable feedback on that.
That's good. Good luck with that, Tony.
Yeah. And go ahead.
If anybody would like to call in for a question or a comment for Tony or for me, you can reach us at 646-478-0981. That's 646-478-0981. Let me talk a little bit. Now, you, your dad, of course, was Jimmy Knapp.
Yeah, Jimmy Knapp. He was known as Jimmy Knapp. It's on his tombstone, too, in parentheses, Jimmy Knapp. Even the Monsignor at the Mass, when we brought him, before we brought him to the cemetery, even the Monsignor called him Jimmy Knapp. FBI called him Jimmy Knapp. Cops called him Jimmy Knapp. Close friends and family called him Grandpa Jimmy Knapp. Jimmy Knapp stayed with him, you know?
Sure. And Tony Knapp is stuck with you, I imagine, huh?
Yeah, because of my father.
Yeah.
And Tony Knapp became me. I'm Tony Knapp. So people started calling me Tony Knapp, and I felt as though it was an honor.
Sure.
But my father said, remember, your name is Napoli.
No,
he always said, nobody's going to own you. You're going to be your own self person. I'll make sure while I'm alive, he said, that nobody's going to ever claim you into any organization, any organized crime family. Your family is right here at home. He said, I'll do what I have to do to keep you going. But he said, if I ever allowed you to become a made man, you wouldn't last too long because you get carried away. He said, and you're above that anyway. So that's what happened to me and my father. It's in the book. It talks about it, you know.
Now, I read it somewhere in the book that when people owed your dad money, sometimes you'd have them in for a chat. And on occasion, he would hand them a gun and tell them to basically go out and get the money.
Yeah, well, that's when he was younger, and he was operating at Tommy Murphy's Pool Hall in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And that was, of course, before he married my mother. And that had to be before 1932. The year 1932. He would give the guy a gun, but it wasn't loaded to go do what he has to do to get him the money he owed him. Yeah, because my father, not that he loaned the money, he was collecting for other guys that were lenders, and he would get a commission on it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he would get upset with a guy when he didn't want to pay him because he knew that the guy was spending money gambling, so why couldn't he pay his debt to the loan shark or whatever it was in those days, you know? In those days, they had no made men. Everybody was connected. There was no such thing as five families when my father was a youngster. There was no such thing. That was created largely by the FBI saying that the Bonomo family, Genovese family, that it was set up by Lucky Luciano. Actually, it was the federal government who put us, because we got five boroughs in New York, they created five families.
Okay, so that was more of a government.
Yeah, because we got five boroughs in New York. The boys weren't interested in five separate families. They were all one at the time, you know, but everybody was considered a connected guy. There was no such thing as a ceremony to become a made guy before 1940. It happened after the Second World War when there was money out there because of the fact that there was private crap games, private gambling, and there had to be control in the areas. But there was no head of a family, of each family. Everybody was connected. Everybody knew each other. And I didn't stress enough of that in the book because of the fact that I wanted to stay closely with a father-son relationship of what I thoroughly knew about the mob life, not what I was guessing on, because my story, I wanted to be as true as possible, and I wanted it to be interesting enough for people to read it that they would follow right into the sobriety at the end of the book.
the gambling operation your dad ran, I assume the numbers was part of that.
Yeah, the number business was my father's thing from Dutch. Dutch Schultz, he had his in Harlem called the New York Action. That was single action. And he cooperated with him because Dutch Schultz was older than my father, and he started before my father in the Harlem area. And he had a cooperation with my father that my father would stay with the Brooklyn number, which is the last three digits of the total mutual handle at the racetrack. That's before OTB was part of the total mutual handle. And it would be the last three digits. And it would be 500 to 1 if you hit the last three digits. You could box it, combination, whichever way, and figure out 500 to 1 is what your winnings would be. And actually, the two odds are 1,001, by the way, for the last three digits, mathematically. But my father got away with paying 500 to one for years, because the other 500 to one that he didn't have to pay out, because he didn't pay true odds, was the money he needed for the cops and the payoff people, you know, and the office help.
Overhead.
Yeah, the overhead. In those days, it wasn't a federal rap in the 1940s and 50s. And it became a federal rap after Harry Gross, one of the first bookmakers to register as a bookmaker in New York, that he was supposed to just pay income tax. But actually, when he did that, they found out the kind of volume he had. And you know what happened to Harry Gross. He got locked up.
And your dad, at one point, too, as a young man, he met a fellow, a New York gangster named Frankie Yale.
Yeah, well, you see, Frankie Yale was the live-in boyfriend of my grandmother, my mother's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Maria. And my mother's father, who was my grandfather, Giuseppe Parada, he died young of a heart attack, 35 years old. After I was born in 1935, I never got to meet my mother's father. But I could very well understand how that poor man died of a heart attack after getting to know my grandmother, who lived and had about four other husbands after that.
Okay.
She was considered a witch and a fortune teller, and Frankie Yale had a stand for her in Coney Island on a boardwalk. And he was the most powerful bootlegger in the New York area at the time, while Al Capone was in Chicago.
And was there a time when Frankie Yale asked your dad to take a load of a truckload of some items?
Yeah, what happened there was in the book. It because we wanted to keep it short and to the point. Frankie Yale met my father when my father was a young teenager. Because my father went to date my mother, who lived in with her mother, and Frankie Yale used to come over to see my grandmother. Sometimes he'd stay overnight because he was a married man with two kids from another woman. He was married while he saw my grandmother. My grandmother was considered like a gumada to him, you know. And my mother got to know Frankie Yale because my mother had no father now. Her father died when he was 35 years old. And my mother introduced my father to Frankie Yale. And so my mother used to kid around and say, I was connected before you ever were, Jimmy. You know, at times my mother considered a housewife, you know, who I dedicated the book to because she was my encouragement. And she gave me most of the information that I have in the book about my father, you know,
right.
And herself. And that truckload, my father and a lot of men like himself were driving truckloads of bootleg liquor and mostly beer to Chicago back and forth and bringing back a load from Chicago. In those days, it was dirt roads. Sometimes they were held up and hijacked by other bandits, you know. But there was quite a few trips that were made when my father was 16, 17, 18, before he got the kiss of death type situation from Al Capone. But in the book, we wanted to expedite things, so we knocked out a couple of years before then, you know, without saying he made two or three trips back and forth. Because, as you know, Frankie Yale died in 1928. He got killed. And the attempted assassination that was involved there, that has never, my father was never convicted on that, never. He was a suspect. Make that understood. And he was given the name by Elliot Ness, the torpedo from Williamsburg, Brooklyn. My father at the time would have been at the age of 19 years old. And he was driving trucks back and forth to Chicago. And that's what I got to say about that. However, people say you're holding back. Let me tell you something. Holding back is one thing, but why hold back if I don't have the answer? I'm not holding back. I just want to tell what I know. because I want to be as honest as possible with my true story, that not to be hypocritical, not to be found hypocritical, because I have my sobriety that are very strong. I have strong feeling thoughts, and I want people to know that. This is a record from the FBI records about Jimmy Knapp, about that attempted assassination on Elliot Ness.
And that that was depicted one time in the Untouchable series, wasn't it, with Robert Stack?
Correct, it was, yes. It was it was called, the segment was called The Kiss of Death. And now, when Elliot Ness did his own autobiography when he was alive, he died an alcoholic, by the way. When he died in 1957, he published his own autobiography. And guess who he's got as the hitman in that book? Tony Napoli. That's me. I wasn't even born yet. And that's confirmed that in Elliot Ness's life story. He published 1957, called the Elliot Ness's autobiography. And he's got Tony Napoli, the hitman, the attempted assassination on himself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you figure out what happened there, you know?
Now,
okay.
You had a couple of stints in Las Vegas, right? I think you came here, when you were representing the mob.
And yes.
The first time was 1958?
That's right, at the Sands Hotel.
Which,
yeah,
where
I met
Frankie Blue Eyes was.
Huh?
And where Frankie Blue Eyes Sinatra was going.
Yeah, yeah, he got himself his teeth knocked out from Ben Cohn, the casino manager from Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
Because Frankie lost $50,000 at the crap table, and Ben took it out of his paycheck. He was entertaining in the Copa room at the Sands Hotel. And Frankie didn't like that. He said, I should have been a high-paid show because I drew people at the crap table. And Cohn told him, he said, listen, we have shills. We don't need that. If you won, you would be looking for your money. You're going to pay. It's deducted from your paycheck. Frankie wouldn't go on the stage that night. And Cohn went into his suite, and he belted him a shot and knocked his teeth out. And Frankie couldn't work for 3 days. And Pat Hendry was the comedian, and Frankie told Pat Hendry, don't go on, stay with me. We're going to boycott this place, you know, with entertainers because of what happened to him. Because he had Eddie Fisher, and he had Victor Moan, and he had Julie Rizzo at the crap table with him. And everybody was, like, throwing the chips around, thinking that they didn't have to pay if they lost. They figured they were shills. Eddie Fisher lost $25,000. Sammy Davis lost $25,000 too, you know.
Ooh.
My father handled that stuff for them, though, you know, made them pay only half.
Now, there's always been talk that Frank Sinatra was a mobster. Did you think he was an actual mobster? He just knew.
Well, Frankie, now, what happened was he, with the contract he had with Tommy Dorsey. It was a lifetime contract Tommy Dorsey had with him, as far, and there was a lot of talk about that contract that Tommy Dorsey was shaking Frankie down, because Frankie wanted to break away and go on his own, but that contract, whatever Frankie did, he had to give 50% to Tommy Dorsey. That was after Harry James. And what happened was Frankie went to a couple of the boys, and matter of fact, he was in Chicago at the time, too, and he met Sam Giancano. And there was some other boys that he met that helped convince Tommy Dorsey to rip up the contract.
an
offer he couldn't refuse.
Out of The Godfather, right? That was something like that.
So Frankie owed a favor to the boys now, didn't he? So therefore, Frankie got stuck with the boys. Now, when I say the boys, I mean the mob boys. So when they wanted a favor, Frankie was there. And wherever Frankie worked at, I don't care, all over the world, it was the calling card for guys like myself to meet. Wherever Frankie's at, if we want to see, we don't have to pick up a phone, we know where to go. If he's at the Sands Hotel in Vegas, Nevada, if he's at Caesar's Palace at the Circus Maximum showroom, go there the days that he's booked there, and we'll bunk into each other, we could talk business. And Frankie was the calling card for us. He didn't even know it himself What do you think of that? He thought he was drawing all the high rollers. We were using him as our place to meet, wherever he was at. We used him as a decoy.
Did you get to meet some of the other Rat Pack guys? I know you said you mentioned Sammy Davis.
Yeah, Joey Bishop. I met Joey Bishop. And there was some other Rat Pack guys that were not celebrities that hung around with Frankie. Some of his close friends, he called them close friends, but they were actually bodyguards. Mm-hmm. You know, there was like Joe Tomatoes, who was a bartender one time for me at the Rag Doll in Union City, New Jersey. Guys like that were part of the Rat Pack. Of course, we know that, I know that Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart put the Rat Pack together originally at the 21 Club. And then when Humphrey Bogart died, then it drifted into Frankie's hands. So what happened with Frankie is that he was their chairman or the chairman of the board, because he was able to talk to the bosses when the celebrities would lose money at the crap tables, because all your celebrities in Vegas at that time, a good percentage, would gamble because they were working for the house and their salary was so much money, and they were able to gamble their whole salary if they wanted. And they all became pathological type gamblers. They didn't know what they were doing. They just wanted the excitement. But Frankie would sit down for them with bosses. So Frankie had the honor of sitting down with men like Carlo Gambino and other Tony Salerno and the bosses to settle problems for celebrities. The thing was, it would be Frankie would represent them. So would you say he was a made man? I would have to say, if you could sit down with bosses, there's no reason why you're not considered a made man. You don't have to do any other kind of work. All you have to do is to produce. You don't have to use the gun to get made.
Okay, so you don't have to kill somebody to be a made man.
Definitely not. Definitely not. Now you get your stool pigeons and they say that they killed this one and that one on a witness stand to convince the jury that they're no good and the defendants are no good because they were associated with the defendants. That stool pigeon makes up a story and gets and he's trying to convince the jurors because he's trying to get all he's doing is lifetime sentence. He wants a little more leniency and he wants to get money if he can. But usually they want them to, there's no hired man, if he gets paid to do a job, will ever be made. He had to do a favor. Any hitman who gets paid will never be a made man.
Okay,
he's just considered a hired hand.
Okay, hired help.
Hired help. Yeah, there you go.
Okay, now, when you were in 58, when you were sent there, what actually were your duties? What did you have to do?
I was supposed to be there to help the high roller, accommodate him, and also make sure that the showroom, the Copa room at the Sands Hotel, that the entertainers would be disciplined enough to show up on time, and also to make sure they were accommodated with the rooms they wanted. Like Sinatra, he wanted more than one room at the time. He wanted like three suites for all his men.
Okay.
And then, of course, he wanted an Oriental, a black, and a white female, you know. Mm-hmm. Not for himself, just so that they could come around and he could look at them. And they could serve him drinks in the suite, like cocktail waitresses.
You know, now, I've heard a lot of stories, and I was doing some research for my books, and most of the stories were that Frank Sinatra, as far as the help, like the dealers and the...
he was that type of guy. He was arrogant. In other words, he'd have chicken, broiled chicken, at the baccarat table. You can't eat at the baccarat table, but they would be lenient with him. He'd order the broiled chicken, and then when he went to taste it, it was cold, and he'd throw it sometimes. You know, you get upset. But if you knew him, he was a very hell of a nice guy, if you knew him. If you didn't know him, and he didn't know you, you couldn't get close to him. You know, forget about it. He was very arrogant.
Was he generous? I've heard stories.
Very generous. There were those people he got fired. Waiters, waitresses, entertainers got fired. He'd send them a check as compensation because the next day he would apologize that way with the person, the individual that he helped to get fired. He would send him some kind of compensation, money-wise.
Uh-huh.
He would do that, yes. And he paid for a lot of hospital bills for a lot of celebrities and a lot of friends that were not celebrities that were sick or something, you know, in a hospital, couldn't afford their hospital bill. Now, he was very generous that way, yes.
Yeah, I've heard that he had, some people said a heart of gold when it came to helping, you know, if somebody was in a spot.
Definitely. Like, he was instrumental in sending some money for Joe Louis's funeral. However, Caesar's Palace did, too. There were others, not just himself, you know. There were others that sent money in for Joe Louis when he passed away. Because, you know, he was a host while I was on the floor at Caesar's Palace, you know, Joe Louis and Johnny Weissmuller.
Right.
Yeah, I was a host on the floor myself with them. And Johnny Weissmuller would go around saying, he would call me son, and people would thought that I was his son, but he never had a son. And when my father got wind of it in New York, he flew out there and he told Johnny Weissmuller off. He said, that's my bird and that's my son. Don't you ever try and claim him. So Johnny Weissmuller didn't know what the hell he was talking about, you know. So Joe Louis said, well, I call him son too. So my father said, well, they could see the difference there. And we, but Joe was a nice, humorous young man, Joe Louis, with me. He wanted me to go on a golf course with him, but I never played golf, you know. And he went out there too early in the morning, and I didn't get up until the afternoon. My night's out. Oh, forget about it.
Now, Tony, when you were at Caesars, that was your second time in Vegas, your second?
I was there three times, and you're out. I was there in the Sands in 58, and then I came back after getting in trouble and getting everybody heated up. And then I went back again, and I went to Caesars in 60. I was sent with the boys to Caesars in 64. And then, I'm sorry, in 67. And then I came back, and then I went back again to Reno, Nevada, and then back to Caesars in 70 when I married the wonderful woman I'm married till today in 1972. But it looked like any time a guy like me would louse up, he got promoted to stay out in Vegas because my father would say, that's where you belong with all the screwballs. He said anybody who's a boss in Vegas in the casinos was a reject from back home. He said we threw them out there because that's where we figured they belong. So I belonged with them, he said. But he knew I had the knowledge.
Right.
He said to me, you show too much knowledge on the floor. You're supposed to just walk the floor, look things, observe things. Then you want to go and relieve a deal in blackjack, and you deal blackjack. Then you go to the crap table, you deal blackjack. Then you go to the baccarat table and you deal baccarat. He said the Jewish mob got so furious that they said they're worried about their positions, that if you guys come to send us guys like this with knowledge, well, we got to worry about our jobs. So they would call up the sheriff's department, somebody behind the scenes, you know, to get rid of me,
mm-hmm.
because I showed the knowledge, you know. But
so you were a threat.
Yeah.
Now, when you got to Vegas, the 67, that would have been your second.
There you go. Yeah, that was a very important year to me. That was after the holdup in New Mexico. Yeah, that's when I got promoted after that particular holdup. Isn't that ridiculous? I got a promotion because I held up a finance company, but I only took the money that I filled out an application. I put my name on there. The guy said, come back at 5 o'clock at night. I went back, and he said to me, well, you've been turned down because your alias is Tony Napoli, Tony Rio, and we don't have the right person on this application. So I said, I put my hand in my pocket, and I said, give me $500 right now, and stamped that application as a loan. So that's what I did, and I beat the case. But it was alone.
So you're in.
But I was drunk too.
you got arrested for that, and you were in the lockup, and then the next thing
3 weeks I was in the lockup and facing 5 to 10 years for armed robbery, and the next thing I know, I'm on a plane to Vegas to Caesar's Palace as a floor boss.
And I remember reading that section in the book, and you got in, and you were greeted warmly, and
yes, very warmly by the three casino bosses at the time. Yes, they were all Jewish.
You've been in jail the day before, the morning.
I was in a cell the morning before. My father flew out there, and the things he could do. He had a luncheon with the senator of the state, and the next thing I know, I was never tried. I was just released and get the hell out of the state. I've never been back to New Mexico since. Never. I was told... The agreement was stay the hell out of our state.
when you were taken up to your room, shown your room at Caesar's that morning, the fellow that took you up ended up giving you a box of business cards, right?
Yes, they were gold lettering business cards with my name on it. And it had my official birth name, Antonio Napoli, casino manager.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then it also gave me some other business cards, too, with my name on it, food and beverage director. They had me directing everything at that palace, for crying out loud, whichever cards I wanted to use.
Now, how did this work? Did the mob kind of control the gambling piece of the casino, or did they...
The mob, this is what happens. Now, it's very important. I don't know. I tried to stress it with my writers that I had three writers help me write that book. Now, I'm not a professional writer. All right, that you understand. I had to hire my writers. If I had known you, Dennis, I would have hired you. Listen. Now, here we go. What happens is we would lease for 1 year the casino from a hotel in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And we'd bring the money in with $1 million. Let's say $500,000. And we would have to have the chips covering $500,000 in cash in the cage. If we were going to give out $500,000 in chips to all the customers, we have to have $500,000 in cash to back up each chip. Okay, you understand that. That's logic.
Right.
All right. Now, we would pay either a percentage of the net to the hotel, or we would give... a flat rate monthly fee to the hotel for a year. But no hotel wants to bank the games. All they want to do is lease out their casino. And it's up to those who lease the casino and bank the games to buy the equipment and hire the dealers and pay the payroll and pay for 50% for the suites that are complimentary for the casino people. We still have to pay 50% of the hotel for that room. If the room is $500 a night, we would pay $250 for our high rollers. So that's how it was controlled. So when I went out there, I was out there with the New York mob, and they would send, they had, let's say, so many points in the place, and they could have, let's say, five guys from New York. I was one of them all the time because of my father.
Right.
And then there was others. Then when the Cleveland mob... had the mob, the Detroit mob. I emphasized and specified mostly about the Cleveland mob because my position was to try and discourage them because they were Meyer Lansky's crew. And Meyer Lansky now was gone, you know, by the time I got out there. And the Cleveland mob was using his power while he wasn't even there, even though he was running around the world trying to find a home, if you recall.
Right.
So anyway, my position was to upset them, but try and stay alive while I'm doing it, you know?
Right. Oh,
but I got carried away because I did upset them, you know? And as you read in the book there, that one character who said, I belong with you-know-what, and I don't want to use that word on the phone.
Right.
And I taught him a lesson, but I got... put on the blacklist, and I never went back to Vegas again. That was at the Tropicana Hotel when I took care of that bone. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, you were at Caesars, the Sands, then Caesars, and then the Tropicana.
I was at the Sands first, then I was at the Caesars, then I was at the Tropicana. And then I got involved at the Stardust with Lefty Rosenthal, who recently died 3 months ago, who Robert De Niro played in Casino, and Nick Pileggi was the writer. Well, Lefty, my father was the one who told Lefty to stay away from me because he called Lefty a gangster. He said, my son's a businessman. You're a gangster. So my father was so right, though, you know.
Yeah.
But Lefty was all right. But he liked to drink, and he was a tall fella, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he was my drinking partner in the afternoons. Yeah. But the story that was very exaggerated, but Nick Pileggi bought the rights to that story, and my friend Lefty Rosenthal, who died a few months ago, sold his life rights. And when that happens, do I have to tell you, you're an author? They do what they want with it. That's why I turned Hollywood down twice recently for offers they gave me if I would sell my life rights to them for this story before the book came out.
Mm-hmm.
Just on one sheet they read the synopsis.
Uh-huh.
They offered me a handsome amount of money, which I, in my own way, even though I've been in sobriety now, I go back once in a while and I start talking like a tough guy if I have to with certain people I think are trying to con me. And I say, are you kidding? I spend that for tip money every year that you offer me, you know? But meanwhile, I don't want to sell my life rights, never. If it never goes to a picture, I'm happy. Only if it goes in and I'm a consultant, and also if I don't have to sell my life rights.
And Tony, when you were at, I believe it was while you were at Caesars, you had a little thing when you caught somebody, as you put in the book, kind of hustle a hustler.
Oh yeah, hustle. Now I was hustling the boys in New York too. That's why my father kept me alive again. Well, he helped keep me alive. Like, I got carried away with the alcohol, and I said, "Jesus, I'm out here walking this floor. Those guys back home, they're getting the money every week. They sent a bag man out here. Let me get over here on this floor. Get a hold of this guy's in trouble, and I'll okay him for 10 grand. Well, in other words, 10 dimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I okay him for that, and I tell him, listen, if you lose, it's under your name. If you lose it, I could squash half of it. I said, but if you win, I got half of it. But you're going to have to pay at least half of it if you lose the whole 10. You're only going to have to pay 5, but, you know, and go and do what you want to do. But then I could also squash the whole thing at the crap table or the blackjack table or the roulette wheel by putting a slip in the box and saying, mark is satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a guy who wants to go to the window that has a marker, and he's giving his chips to someone else, a friend of his, to cash them in, and that's when I have to be on the lookout. Because I'm not getting a piece of that. The boys are not getting a piece of that. This guy's beating us. So now I power up on him by going after his partner who's at the window, cashing his chips in that he slipped to him, because the original, the owner of the chips owes a marker, and in those days you had to satisfy your marker before you got the rest of the money at the gauge. We call that integrity and honor among thieves, that the guy would have to admit when he's asked at the cage, do you owe a marker here? Because it would be signed, you know, with the slips that come in from the box every hour.
Mm-hmm.
Perpetual inventory we took of the chips on each table. We had counters that would count and look at the trays fast, you know.
Right.
You ever see a casino guy go behind the dealer and all of a sudden he's starting to separate his chips and then he walks away? He's count perpetual inventory of the chips on that table.
And
they know what they started with.
Right. And when you found somebody trying to pull a fast one, how did you handle them?
I took them out to the desert. I got a hold of the house limo. We had the driver, and I'd sit the guy in the back and talk to him privately and talk to him nice. And he'd say, where are we at? I'd say, now get out of the car. I want to talk to you privately. And I'd tell him, now take your pants off and run, you bastard. And I'd leave him there. Doesn't mean he died. It was on a highway. The highway from Vegas to L.A. is 325 miles.
Right.
And now it used to be dirt road. But there was motels. There was places. Let him run. And, I mean, was that heartless? I was a drinker man, remember. I wouldn't do that today. I'm making amends today for things like that I did. But I never got any calls that the guy was found dead or something. No, that's why I put it in the book, is the way it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I teach him a lesson. And then he would tell other people, don't clown around at Caesars. Don't clown around at the Sands. That Tony Knapp is a nut or something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But my father always said, wouldn't you have been better off making arrangements to have the guy pay than to let him run away?
Now,
yeah.
There, Tony, there came a time when, let's go, I'm going to advance a little bit and talk about the opening of your book. And
yes.
In the opening of your book, you describe
yes,
the morning
yes.
you went to a college.
Yes, yes.
You were in a bad mood. And tell us about that.
That punk, he hurt my daughter. And the next day, I was out on a handling my after-hour places in Manhattan, and I came home and I saw my daughter, and she was in her room. The bedroom door was cracked open a little bit, and she was a studious girl. She doesn't miss school. And I went to her mother, which is my wife, and also her daughter. And my oldest daughter came to me, and she told me what happened. And I called up a couple of my crew guys at the time, because at the time I was a drinking man, you know. And my father already passed away a year prior to that, so I couldn't go to him. So I had to handle this myself and take the law into my own hands, because there was no way that my daughter wants to call the cops. She's not going to do that. And she went to the family doctor. She didn't go to the hospital, because she wanted to keep it out of the newspapers. She didn't want to publicize what happened to her. But, of course, my oldest daughter, Veronica, told me everything. And I went there, and I had my daughter, which I shouldn't have done. I had her get in the car to point the punk out to me the next morning in school at 9 o'clock in the morning. And after she pointed him out in the hallway, I had one of my crew members drive her back home. And I stayed there with the punk, and I took care of him, and I threw him against the wall, and he didn't know who the hell I was. And he said, who the F are you? And he said the whole word, though. I don't want to curse on the phone. I don't know if you're censored here.
Okay.
So anyway, I threw him through the door. I thought it was an exit door going down the steps, because we were one flight up from the street. And sure enough, it was a classroom that I threw him through, and he hits the floor. And he tries to reach in his boot for the switchblade knife that I was told by my daughter that he carries. And I got it first. I grabbed it at him, and I said, I'm not familiar with switchblades. I'm used to bayonets and stuff when I was in guerrilla warfare in the Strategic Air Command overseas when I was in the United States Air Force. However, this bastard... I started hitting him and punching him with it, but the blade slipped out, and all of a sudden, the next thing I know, I'm slicing his testicles, his nipples, his backside, everything else.
Wow.
And I told the kids in the classroom, any girls here, there was 22 kids I know, because they all showed up in court 8 months later. I said, any of you girls, he did this to you, what he did to my daughter. I said, let me tell you something, you go to the security guards now. And I threw that damn knife on the floor, and the college professor... came from London, England, ran out the door, never came back to the United States again. Never came back. And he saw everything. He just didn't want to be a witness for anything. Well, the punk's family made him testify and admit what he did. That helped my sentencing. I still got 3.5 years. I was facing 8.5 to 23. My daughter today is happily married, and it took her a long time to date. That was in November of 1993, and it was an awful scene there. And that's where it was my turning point, when 3 squad cars picked me up outside the college. I wasn't running. I knew my life was over with at that time. I felt it was. And that was the last time I ever had a drink. And I went into an alcoholic coma in court, and the VA hospital took care of me, and that's how I found sobriety. And I stayed above my sentence. In other words, I stayed 5 years instead of 3.5. Why? Because I became a counselor for the recovery program at the VA hospital. I was sentenced to the hospital ward by Judge Joan O'Dwyer, who understood what I was going through, and that it was a sensitive case. However, I did say to the judge that, Your Honor, before sentencing, I said, that boy, that punk needs. Now, I didn't say I was calling him a punk, but at sentencing, I called him that boy. What he needs, he was 19 years old. He needs therapy like I need for my alcoholism, and I didn't give him the therapy he needed. And she said she took off 5 years on my sentence by me making that statement, because I proved that I was 8 months in therapy before the trial, before it started, that I wanted the doctors at the VA hospital at Fort Hamilton had stated that they wanted to make sure I was ready to testify. And, of course, as you know in my book, that Barry Slotnick, the well-known lawyer, was a spectator in the courtroom. And he was also the lawyer for Vincent Gigante. And at that time, they were all alive, you know. And I would never take a witness stand unless if it was going to jeopardize any of the men that I knew and called uncle or something. I had a respect because of my father. But I was told I could take it now because I'm defending myself and my daughter's honor. So I took the witness stand. I wanted permission. I wanted to know. I did not take the witness stand without confirming with the higher-ups. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to jeopardize it. But the condition was that they wouldn't ask me any questions about my lifestyle other than that incident. Mm-hmm. And I said I wanted to help the jurors. And, of course, with the jurors, I said to them, I'm going to give you my scenario. I was made a deal with the DA and the judge here. They're going to allow me to talk without being interrupted with objections or sustained. So I'm telling you, jurors, fast, that you're not going to meet my daughter. I made the deal that she doesn't come up on this stand. I've done enough that causes her enough trauma after what she went through. I understand now what happened, and I want you jurors to know that when you go home and you see your grandchildren or your daughter going to school in the morning, no matter what kind of a school it is, that's my daughter too, and you think that she's going to be safe, and that's what happened to me.
So what that obviously had an impact on the jury.
Oh yeah, well, they started. There was a few of them crying, but there was some. There was four veterans on there, four men that were veterans, and it took them 25 minutes to come back and find me guilty on one out of six counts. From one incident, how they throw so many counts against you, you know?
Sure.
You think I had four arms and four legs or something where I kicked the bastard. So anyway, they came back. And then afterwards, 2 weeks afterwards, well, the jurors, they hugged and kissed me afterwards. Then 2 weeks after that, one of the alternate jurors came to see me because his son was on drugs and wanted me to ask my advice of what I could do about it to help his son. Imagine that one. Yeah, one of the alternate jurors, yes. I spoke to his son, yeah. And at the time, I slapped the kid. My settlement was slap the kid in the mouth, you know, look in his eyes and scare the hell out of him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what happened with me? I was telling these kids, you're better off drinking a shot of whiskey than on that drug, that stuff. How wrong I was on that one, too. I got to go from one addiction to another. Oh, my God, until I learned to do it myself, what I was doing. But these kids there, the fathers and mothers were happy the kid was drinking a bottle of beer than the marijuana.
Sure. So what you were saying was you thought, you know, that day when you after you confronted that kid there at the college, you thought your life was kind of over, but it turned out to actually be a new beginning.
Yes, because of the fact that, yeah, unfortunately what happened to my poor daughter, and then some good came out of it on my part because I found sobriety, yes. And when I was sentenced to the VA hospital instead of the penitentiary because of the statement I made to Judge Jonah Dwyer, she was ready to send me upstate someplace for 8.5 to 23 years for attempted murder, you know?
Yeah,
but the jurors knocked everything down to a felony in the third degree, and I got 3.5 years. And in the hospital ward, she was impressed, the judge, because I was in the program for 8 months. Before the trial started, too, to straighten myself out.
Mm-hmm.
So I could help the jurors make a decision. My My platform was, Your Honor, give me time and I'll help that jury. I'll take that witness stand. And I'll help these jurors because there's no other person that can give this, my side of the story but me, myself.
That's right.
So I was the only one that on my side was myself. I probably could. You know what two of the jurors told me afterwards? They said, we had you not guilty on everything because the witnesses got all confused. They had you different descriptions. They had me not guilty all the way on everything. Oh, my God.
We're time's going by quicker. I want to switch just a second and ask you a question about, you know, you used to box as a middleweight, right, under the name of Tony Rio?
Correct, yes.
Okay. I got to ask you this question. It's just curiosity on my part. I'm originally from upstate New York near Canastota, where the Boxing Hall of Fame is and where Carmen Basilio's home is.
Yes, of course. He was a friend of mine.
And what I often wonder today, I used to see some, I never saw Basilio fight live, but I've seen, you know, on, I used to buy Ring magazine all the time. They always had photos in it, and I've seen some of the biography stuff. And he was obviously a very well-conditioned, tough guy. But I'm wondering today, some of the fights that he won, when I see the photos or the films, he looked like a loser because he would be...
I know where you're leading. You're leading to the judges and the referee, right?
Exactly.
All right, so that's what we call entertainment. In other words, somebody got to a judge, but different eyes see different things.
Right.
So somebody, one of the promoters... or to try and get a rematch for a hometown kid, if it goes to a decision, the philosophy went like this. If you're standing on your feet after the bell of the last round, you have a chance of winning a decision.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not on your feet after the last round, you get knocked out, you lose. You're a loser all the way. And the bettors are losers, too, that bet on you. So somebody got to a judge. Somebody got to a referee because the majority of the people like yourself, with your eyes, you saw something different, and yet it came out the other way.
Yep.
That's called getting to a judge. In those days, remember, you're talking about, the referee was also a judge.
Right.
That's right. And I don't think they had the card girls going in with the cards at ringside. I don't know. Maybe they did. I don't remember that. You know, the girls that come in there with the bikinis on with the round one, round two, round three.
Yeah.
Distract.
Yeah.
But that's what we call entertainment. And therefore, we don't call it fixed fight. We call that entertaining.
Entertainment. Now, you do a little work with boxers today, don't you? You still have your...
Every month. Ring 8. My father helped form it in... April of 1954. Patty DeMarco won the lightweight title of the world in March 5th, 1954. At Madison Square Garden, he was a 4-1 or 7-1 underdog for Jimmy Carter for the lightweight title of the world. 15 rounds it was.
Mm-hmm.
And Patty DeMarco wins a unanimous decision. Now, my father gets subpoenaed the next morning. He was the promoter behind it.
Uh-huh.
And in the book, it tells you that most of those words came from, that's on in the court scripts, that Patty DeMarco questioned about Jimmy Knapp was his financial advisor. Patty DeMarco's manager died about 8 or 9 months before that. His name was Jimmy Dixon. Jimmy Dixon was close to Jimmy Knapp. Jimmy Knapp helped Jimmy Dixon with his influence to get fights for all his fighters, to get matches at Madison Square Garden. So Patty looked up to Jimmy Knapp after his manager Jimmy Dixon died, and Jimmy Dixon told Patty, stay with Jimmy Knapp. He's the only man in the business that has integrity and compassion towards the fighters. So Patty stayed with my father, and my father never admitted to being Patty's manager or anything, just his financial advisor. And my father took care of Patty after he retired from boxing for the rest of his life. He even got him as a floor boss to see his powers as in the blackjack pit.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, my father was able to get jobs for a lot of ex-fighters doing that. Well, anyway, with the Ring 8 thing, I go every month. We have our meetings. Matter of fact, the 21st of this month, we have our Christmas annual Christmas dinner. And we get other fighters in, and we give awards out, you know, for Trainer of the Year, Ring 8 Trainer of the Year, this and that. And the indigent fighters, what we do, I can't say what I do. I say what we do, because we do it as a group. There's over 330 of us members. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we help them with their prescriptions that they don't have enough money, hospitalization, rent money. These are fighters like who were champs and are broke today. And they come to us because we send word out. We find them. They don't have to find us. We find them. And they could have been a four-round fighter, preliminary fighter. They didn't have to be a champ. We helped them. And through donations. And we get our donations in, and that's how we do it. And I solicitate for donations for Ring 8. Nobody can give me the check. I tell them where to mail it to, right to the Ring 8 treasurer.
And you also, you know, just before we move on, I just want to say it's a shame of some of these fighters, you know, that end up in the situation where they can't pay their rent, when they don't have any.
But 80% of the, maybe 90% of it has nothing to do with the manager or the trainer. It has to do with the fighter himself, who became a gambler. And most of the time they blame it like, in Joe Lewis's case with the managers and whatnot and a piece of this, and James J. Braddock taking 50% of everything Lewis did after they gave him that title fight that Lewis won. Well, this situation is most of the time that I found these fighters were gamblers and drinkers and loved to go nightclubbing.
So they were responsible to some degree for their problems.
Yeah. And themselves, they punish themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially today with the big money. Here comes a kid now, all of a sudden out of left field, he makes himself $500,000 for the fight. Bump, and all of a sudden, you don't hear about him anymore. Where'd he go?
Mm-hmm.
He wind up going bad.
We've only got about 3 minutes left, Tony. I want to talk a little bit about too what you're doing now with veterans. Can you explain a little bit?
And what I'm doing is a veteran gets turned down for his service-connected injuries because he couldn't prove what happened to him and where it happened at while he was on active duty. So I do the discovery on that form, and I do the appeals free of charge. And all veterans, they could get a hold of me through My Father, My Don, my website, myfathermydon.com. And they could all get a hold of me that way because it's not just My Father, My Don, a mob story. It's also a story about veterans and what they could do.
Mm-hmm.
How they could find help. And recovering alcoholics, I'm very busy with every day.
Do you find that there are a lot of veterans who do have trouble that deserve benefits and have trouble getting them?
Yes, because the paperwork is not done correctly, and we don't have enough supervisors with the knowledge to do the paperwork correctly. I'm a volunteer, and there are those who are on salary at the VA offices, and they, when a veteran tells them that Tony Napoli did my form for me, and he's a volunteer, and they say to him, well, he's a volunteer, what could he know? You see, the word volunteer throws them off. A volunteer is a dedicated man, a passionate man, who's also a disabled veteran himself most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I am. I'm a disabled veteran, too, myself.
And you say you also do a lot of work with the alcoholics, recovering
alcoholics. Alcoholics, I pay a lot of attention towards recovering alcoholics. Most of the alcoholics who are also looking for service-connected injuries as well, went to alcohol after service. They claim they started drinking the first time in the service. I believe that. They claim the first cigarette they had is when they were drafted 18 or when they enlisted. I believe that, but they put that in their mouths. It wasn't forced in them, so I trained them. I schooled them, and I say, no, don't you understand? That's not service-connected. You can't use that. We have to show that you did not look for this injury. It was brought upon you because you were stationed in the area where this government sent you. Mm-hmm. And that's how I get out of them, the post-traumatic stress people, especially from Vietnam. They have to remember. They can't remember. I draw it out of them. I tell them, where were you? Where's your buddies? What was the name of the squadron? I look in the computer. I find their buddies that were there. And most of the time, their buddies are getting a disability, and they were in the same action that they were in, and they're not getting it because they didn't know how to go about it. Well, and that should be explained more thoroughly by this government.
You're right. Tony, we're out of time. I don't know where the hour went to, but I want to thank you so much for being my
guest.
Thank you,
Dennis. I'll be looking forward to meeting you personally one of these days.
Thank you, and you and your family have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Dennis.
Bye, Tony.
Bye-bye.
And thanks for listening. The guest, Tony Napoli, the book, My Father, My Don. Thank you very much. We'll catch you next time. Good night.